Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
A British national is among seven aid workers killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza, according to the World Central Kitchen charity. Despite coordinating moves with the Israeli Defence Force, the charity says the convoy was hit as it was leaving a warehouse. The government is delivering on its childcare plan, according to the Prime Minister. The first parents in England are benefiting from 15 hours of taxpayer-funded care for two-year-olds. Our reporter Jules Utterbridge has more.
Labour says families will struggle to access places, but the Prime Minister says the plan will help to build a brighter future for families. Officials have confirmed the number of parents who have taken up places will initially be in the thousands, but over the coming weeks, that number is expected to grow by tens of thousands.
And NHS England is starting to identify people with type 1 diabetes who could benefit from a new technology described as an artificial pancreas. It uses a glucose sensor under the skin to automatically calculate how much insulin is delivered via a pump. Tens of thousands of people could be offered the technology. That's the latest from Radio News Hub. I'm Stephen Davis.
And here's Rory McIlroy on the 18th at Augusta.
And here it goes. Surely not. Goal!
Some things are worth shouting about. Watch all 4 days of the Masters exclusively live on Sky Sports. Get all of Sky Sports for £22 extra a month. See sky.com for details. New 18-month contract for Sky TV required. Further terms apply.
Coming up, Africa in Focus.
Imagine, it's Wednesday. 1 minute you're at the gym, you're doing it, getting those steps in, not thinking about pizza, and definitely not clock watching. Only 56 and a half more minutes left. And the next, that'll do. You're a millionaire. Lotto, will you be next? Play on app, the National Lottery. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Africa in Focus.
Colorful.
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 Genius.
Colorful. Colorful Radio.
Welcome to Africa in Focus again. I'm your host, Julius Baluto. We are in London School of Economics, and it's that day of Africa Summit. We are today at London School of Economics today. Very great day because they are hosting their 10th Africa Summit. And of course, we are talking about a summit whereby we have seen a lot of people coming from Africa, from leaders, presidents. Today, graced by Professor Tim Allen, and I'm also with the senator from Nigeria.
Yes, sir.
Asuguo
Epeng.
Epeng.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you, and it's good to have you both. It's good to have you both. So we will just kick off today with a theme that has been running through the morning, and it was about education. Education is a very serious thing, but in Africa, I just want to start with by illustrating where we are in Africa right now with education that I've seen. Sad, kind of, but we have made a lot of progress. But let's start with this one. Now, a small child, a teacher noted, never liked to do homework. And the teacher was very concerned. Why don't you ever do your homework? And the small child tells the teacher, because my brother told me, education doesn't matter. And the teacher says, what matters? He says, my brother told me is who you know. Now, the teacher says, what does your brother do? He say, he's still at home. He say, why? He says, because he doesn't know anyone. So it's about who you know, but he didn't know anyone. And his perception actually is a metaphor for what's going on in Africa. Children growing up, looking up to educated brothers, after they graduate, they have no jobs. And that impacts upon the young ones all along the way. They are looking up, okay, we were told education is very important, but now, what do we see? Our man up there, he doesn't have a job. And I think maybe we can start with you, Professor, and I want to finish that part of the question, which is a lot of governments in Africa now today, they will engage services of international companies, countries to build infrastructure and whatever. On the ground, they are churning out engineers from universities, but these companies come, like Chinese one, they come with their engineers, and African engineers have got no jobs. Let's start with you, with that observation.
I mean, look, there's a huge problem and a huge opportunity on the African continent. It's an extraordinarily young population. There are vast numbers of young people in Africa, and that's an extraordinarily precious thing, but it also raises different sorts of problems and expectations, which are going to have major political consequences moving forward. And you know, what you're picking up is crucially important, that you have vast numbers of young people completing primary education, or maybe even secondary education, or maybe even university education, and they have no prospect of getting formal employment. It's not that they're not working. You only have to go to an African village or an African city, and you see everybody's working, but they're not necessarily working in the formal sector. They're not necessarily paying taxes. They're not necessarily being protected in normal kind of labour, regimes and organisational structures. And that is a massive problem. How is it going to be possible to employ all these young people in Africa in a productive way, and in a way that can build countries, so that they become engaged, if you like, in the nation building project, rather than becoming migrants trying to find a living, moving from place to place. Because politically, that's going to be disastrous.
Indeed. And to you, Senator, the key thing, perhaps, maybe, problem within formulation of policies within governments sectors, especially formulation of policies, because we cannot stay without international trade. We cannot stop without development and engagement in different countries, whether it's building infrastructure or whether it's whichever in kind of corporations government to government go into. We cannot do away with that. But do you think maybe it's about time whereby, from an African perspective now, when government engage services of a global player like China to put quotas, so like, come to our country, build the infrastructure, but don't bring all the engineers, 5% or less?
Okay, so let me start with, so Professor Allen and I are just coming from the fireside chat where I think most of the discourse we spoke about, it was Ecuador, curriculum development, having curriculum that is relevant to today's needs. Any education that is practical knowledge, that is critical thinking, that is problem solving to issues that are relevant today will always be sought after. And so it behoves on our institutions to formulate curriculum, tie the curriculums to the needs and the requirements of today, as opposed to just carrying on with curriculums that are decades old. When you speak about services and international trade or engagement of the services of foreign companies or organizations, in Nigeria we have laws on local content, we have expatriate quotas, and I can tell you as a matter of fact, most businesses are mercantile in nature. If it's going to be cheaper for them to come to a country and execute a contract or a project using local resources, they will do it. It's capital. It's about profit and loss for them, as opposed to having to bring in expatriates, because whoever they bring in from their country would be seen as an expatriate, have to pay certain fees and expatriate, and limited by expatriate quotas. And some countries even have what they call expatriate levies, which they charge some of these companies. So if there are resources on ground that can fit the bill and enable them to execute whatever project and contract effectively and efficiently, I can assure you they will look to do it. But the government now comes in place and also further highlights that by putting a local content law where those expatriates coming in have a limited time to which they can spend and must transfer knowledge and skills such that when that contract, another leg of that contract is being executed, the local resources will be utilized.
But I mean, it varies, doesn't it, very differently from one African country to another.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're coming from Nigeria, which is
Nigeria.
A very different kind of situation, yeah, isn't it? But the levels of education in Nigeria are astonishing compared with South Sudan or even Uganda, where there's quite a high level of education, but nothing like Nigeria. I was really amused when I was in Lagos recently. I was the only white person with my a young white colleague, yeah, in the market. We were the only ones. And, you know, in East Africa, people were going, Muzungu, Muzungu, white people, yeah? Like,
yeah?
In Nigeria, they weren't. They were being very friendly. Yeah. But they were assuming, because she was younger and I looked like some old duffer,
yeah,
they thought I must be taking her to the market for getting her something.
Yeah.
And they were going, oh, graduate, graduate, you know, assuming that maybe she'd, you know, I was taking her to the market to get a present for having graduated.
Okay.
And so I just thought that's a very sort of Nigerian response. You wouldn't have that in other places. So you know, so I think, you know, your point is a very important one. But in other places, those sort of constraints are not there. And I wonder whether, I mean, you mentioned the Chinese investment. Of course, there's a problem there with language, because often you have Chinese companies operating with Chinese engineers and so on who are not speaking. They can't speak to the local population. That is a big problem. They can't. In Uganda, for example, where they're building this big dam, they don't have local. They have, you know, labourers maybe, but they don't have people that they can communicate with. That can be a problem. But I think there's one other factor which I would like to get for us to discuss, which is that in other parts of the world, in Asia, for example, there's been this massive growth in wealth, driven by industrialization, based upon cheap labor, actually. Massive amounts of cheap labor kind of drove industrialization in Asia. That's not really an option in the African continent. You have this huge population, but mass industrialization with cheap labor is not going to happen in the same way again because of all the new developments in technology. Robots are cheaper. So if it's not going to be mass, people are not going to be employed in sort of mass production, in concentrations of labour. What are we going to do? How are those young people going to be? How are they going to be employed? What should they be employed to do? And it's not just a few engineers here and there, or a few thousand. We're talking about millions of people. We're talking about 80% of the population in some countries. How are those people going to be employed? We have to think about it in completely new ways. You know, maybe things like the arts and creative industries, some kind of version of universal basic income for people to have productive lives that benefit the community, if you like. Maybe we need to think in those ways. I do feel we have to think outside the box. We really do. And it's not obvious to me that there is a drive towards solutions that are going to work.
It's a very good point you make there. And while technology seems to obviously be a hindrance, obviously, like it's a barrier because of, you know, cheaper ways of doing things, just utilizing robots and technology. Do you also see an opportunity with technology with you know, stronger internet connectivity, the Internet of Things, where people no longer have to migrate to provide services? So people could be in one part of the world, living there and providing a lot of services to other parts of the world. I'm just thinking, just I'm brainstorming as
yeah.
well. So while technology is also a liability, it could also be an asset.
It's a huge asset, isn't
yeah.
it? I mean, like, you know, African countries don't have to worry about putting in phone lines. I mean, you say, oh, how are you going to have, you know, landlines? It would just seem bonkers nowadays,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, so there's been that leap.
Yeah.
And with the new opportunities, with, you know, new kinds of technologies,
yeah.
AI and so on, there's a massive opportunity. But is it linked to employment? Is it linked
yeah.
to giving young people jobs? That's where I have the concern.
So it's not going to be employment in the sense it was decades ago, where, you know, you would go into an office, but it would give a lot of opportunities to entrepreneurs.
Okay.
Okay.
I think it will give a different, you know, a different spin to what employment typically is. So I go back to the provision of services while being in a different geographical location. I think there's an opportunity there. I know it's limited in terms of numbers because you speak about millions of people.
Millions.
But if one person was able to set up a business like that and was able to employ more people within that system, then you have an ecosystem of people providing services across the world. So you mentioned entertainment, which is one of I think one of our greatest exports.
Nigeria, absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
When you delve into that market, there are service providers in that sector. So you may see one man at the front who's providing the entertainment, but there's a team of people, and if that's replicated and there's a bit more ease of being able to monetize content across the internet, then there's a vast opportunity, I think. So it goes back to the fact that education has to change to what is relevant in terms of the needs of the market. So it's always about demand and supply.
This is Colorful Radio.
Colorful Radio.
Colorful.
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 Genius.
Colorful. Colorful Radio.
Exactly. There is a controversial phrase another academic used to use, talking about the quality of education that is taught in universities or schools in Africa, and he pointed out that sometimes we spend time teaching people the number of legs a mosquito has, and
or how to dissect a cock.
And you grow up and you go looking for jobs, no one will ask you how many legs does a mosquito have.
The education I had at school wasn't very relevant. Nobody ever told me how a car engine worked. It's like you'd have thought, education often isn't very practical, isn't it?
It should be practical, but maybe it should be more practical. A bit more controversial. Again, when we look up into the world order, the national system and all this, we have prestigious universities scattered across the globe. Talk about London, LSE, Oxford, go to US, Harvard. But in terms of thinking selfishly, like we can one day live in one world, the question is, who in the hierarchy of knowledge, who owns it, who has a copyright? And if education was about sharing knowledge, how is that shared? And will there ever be parity? Will there ever be parity whereby selflessness, whereby Korean engineers will go to Africa and Tanzania and say to them, this is our car, it's done, let's do it together. We're living in the same world.
That would be a nice world.
The world, I think someone said knowledge is power.
Yeah.
So if you put it in that context, no one gives power. You have to, so no one is going to come and freely give power. People may give knowledge, but there's knowledge is power, it's capital. It's almost like money in the sense of it's patented these days. People copyright it. People want to monetize it. So it's never really going to be free. So if you want to be realistic, we have to think about it in today's terms of let's say free market, and you have to either build it through R&D, research and develop that knowledge, or you have to acquire it by, spending to acquire it. I think that's the most simple terms I can.
Yeah,
I'll just follow on for the same point.
I think we have to think, if you like, about what knowledge is. It'd be nice to think that all knowledge should be open to everybody, and then one can put mechanisms in place, if you like, to make a space in which sharing does occur. I mean, in the UK, for example, I work in a publicly funded university. So if I go to give a lecture in another university in the UK, I wouldn't charge for it. That's part of my duty as being an academic, in a publicly funded institution. And, you're interviewing me and I'm not charging you for the interview. That's part of what I have to do. I have to share my knowledge, and it's understood that's part of my job. Other places are not like that, actually. I mean, if I go to the United States and give a talk, people pay me for it often. So these things can be quite different from one place to another. But there's also the more fundamental issue, I think. It is, if you like, there a quest for all the knowledge that's out there, and the knowledge, if you like, is sort of in nature and we access it, or is knowledge actually about argument? It's about you saying one thing and me countering it with another thing. I think knowledge, the way we engage with knowledge and the way we come to understand things, is not by collectively sharing information. It's by having arguments, actually, isn't it? It's about having arguments and asking better questions. And I think that's a really important insight. You know, what I really want to see with my African colleagues working in African universities is that they ask me really difficult questions. And they say, I don't like your question. I don't like the way you're thinking about it. I think you should think about it in this different way and ask this different question. Because then, in that discussion, we learn something from each other. And so I think it's that confidence and capacity for people to be able to ask questions. Not necessarily in an aggressive way, but in an inquiring way and expect a debated answer, not an imparting of facts that I never questioned.
Oh, thank you. That's great. And of course, you are the host of the African Summit. For someone who doesn't know what it's all about, how important is it and how important has it been to the university?
Well, I mean, to the university, I can certainly say for the university. I mean, honestly, when, you know, I was head of international development here for many years, and I taught courses on African development and all sorts of issues with an African focus, and I had hardly any African students. And, you know, when I look at the curricula that we were teaching and still are teaching, there are African authors there, but not enough. And there's a kind of a hegemony of particular perspectives, which may be useful, but they need to be critiqued, they need to be debated. And that hasn't been there as much as it should be. And I felt that Africa as a continent, if you like, was being treated, for all sorts of reasons, partly funding, in a different way to the rest of the world. And so, you know, colleagues would write about China or North America or Asia within a global context without there being, if you like, a kind of quality of exceptionalism about it. And so when I stopped being head of international development, I thought it'd be really important to create what was initially an Africa Centre and then an Africa Institute, where we try and sort of bring Africa into the core of things. Not as an exceptional space where we look at particular things that happen in Africa. We might do that too, but to think about Africa in the way we think about other parts of the world, whether we do it locally or whether we do it internationally. And so that's what we've tried to drive at the LSE. And frankly, I feel we've been pushing at an open door. We only have to say it and people think, oh yes, you know, well, who could be opposed to it? You know, after all, you know, particularly for the UK after Brexit, if it's not going to be Europe, who is our near abroad? It's Africa, isn't it? And all those young people we've been talking about in Africa, where are they going to go? Are they going to come to Europe? And Europe might resist and complain and put up boundaries, but our future's going to be entwined with Africa. So if we've got an ageing population, we need Africa youth. Our future is bound up with African youth. So I think we need to take these things really seriously and engage with them. And so my objective from an LSE point of view is to bring Africa into the core of it. And the Africa summits have been a huge aspect of that. They've been run by African students at the LSE, and they've done it in an extraordinary professional manner year on year. We give them support, but they do it themselves. They come up with the topics. They create the spaces and the debates. And they've been hugely successful. This is our 10th one. They're self-financing, and you know they have a huge outreach now. You know, not just at the LSE, but way beyond. And you know, it's a space in which these core debates, core issues that are at the heart of change in Africa, you know, have a space here at the LSE where Africans can debate with one another and debate with people from other parts of the world within this sort of context of a university that purports to be a university for the world. Well, let's make it a university for the
it's
world.
It's becoming.
You can't do that without Africa in the heart of it.
Yeah, it's becoming.
And we've got this, I mean, you can't see it because we have this new building that we've managed to raise funding for down there with some scaffolding on it. That's going to be our new institute building. And in the future we'll have the Africa Summit and the Agora in that building.
That's amazing. That's amazing. No, you're doing great work. And of course, this was amazing moments of great conversations. And I'm sure it's not going to end there. Sometime follow-ups to see. Sometime you do something and there's, what was the impact?
Yeah.
Do you sometime do follow-ups?
Yeah, I mean, when you say follow-ups, what do you mean? I do very long-term research.
So I've
worked in certain parts of Africa since probably before you were born. I don't know when you were born. But I mean, I started working in parts of Central Africa in the early 80s, and I continue to go back to those places. Yeah. I follow populations. I've lived for many years in African countries. I've spent 4 years living in South Sudan and many years in Uganda and other places. And so I do long-term research there, and I'm doing one of the projects I'm doing at the moment, actually, is looking at what happens to young people when they come back from armed conflicts. There's lots of emphasis on, you know, disarmament, demobilization in post-war, post-conflict situations, but they only go on for a year or 2 years, then the funding ends. But sometimes thousands of young people have been forced into armed conflicts. Then they come back, and then the funding ends for the project, and they disappear. Well, where are those people? What's happened to them? And so we have this long-term study, for example, of what happened to those young people, thousands of them, thousands and thousands, who came back from the Lord's Resistance Army in northern Uganda, you know, looking at how they live within the population.
Child soldiers.
Exactly. And then we do a lot of long-term research on different things. I mean, I'm really committed to doing long-term long-term work. And we also do that with we have this program within the Institute called, I mean, I have to say I was a bit embarrassed when I was asked by Firoz Lauji, who kind of is one of our supporters, to do it. He wanted us to have a program for African leadership. And I was saying to Firoz, you know, like, the last thing we want is for some, you know, white, late middle-aged professor lecturing people on African leadership. And I said, that's not going to be a good look. But the way that it's worked is that it's driven by the African students themselves.
Yep.
So, in fact, the students who run the summit are members of this program for African leadership.
Yep.
And what we do is that for all the graduate students at the LSE, we provide them with this space, which we call the Program for African Leadership, and they agree to a code of behavior in the future. You know, how they will act when they leave the university, how they will act in business, how they will act in government, and they will remain in contact with each other. So they're all networked with each other. There's now about 800 of them across the African continent. And at the LSE, it becomes, if you like, their space. And then we organise events for them where they meet parliamentarians, or they pretend to see the gold in the Bank of England or something like that. And they kind of, there's all these extra projects we have around the time they're at the LSE, and then they debate with each other about politics. And I have to say, it's worked amazingly well, and it's nothing really to do with me, it's to do with the students themselves and the space in which they can shape it. Every couple of years we try to have an event in Africa where we bring many of them together to discuss where they are now, and many of them remain in contact. And you know, it's a wonderful thing, you know, because Africa is disappointingly divided. We were talking about this earlier on today in one of the sessions, that there's often not much communication between African countries. Now we have these, I mean, it's a small thing, but we have our PFAL graduates who are networked with each other. You know, so I'm going and talking to colleagues in Uganda, and they know people in Kenya, and they know people in Nigeria, and they know people in South Sudan, and they know people in South Africa, and they're finding out what has happened to them, whether they're married, whether they've got children, what jobs they've got, are they coming to, are people travelling? When I go to South Sudan, I'm met at the airport by former PFAL students, and
That's brilliant.
It creates a connection.
Power of networks.
A power of networks, and it's surprisingly absent. Not completely, but it's surprising how absent it is in the African continent.
Colorful radio.
Colorful
radio.
Great day. I'm joined by the ambassador, His Excellency Ndola Mukwe, and is a Democratic Republic of Congo's ambassador to the UK. And it's a great pleasure to be with you.
It's my pleasure.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Let's start by, of course, you've been here, you've listened, maybe people talking about that Africa Summit. What do you make of about the whole day? How has it been from your own observation?
Yes. No, it has been great. First of all, to see that Africa is a topic of conversation, and to see that there are Africans taking part in that conversation. It is a conversation about Africa with Africans. So for me, that was a very big plus.
And the key thing has been the focus on education. You're from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say right now is the state of education in DRC Congo?
Okay. This is a hot topic because we all know that, as Professor Kizerbo of Burkina Faso said, educate or perish. If we do not give priority to education, definitely we are not giving priority to the development and to the well-being of our populations. The situation now in DRC is that because of the economic challenges, the high education has been facing quite a few problems. A lot of students, poor infrastructure, a high rate of unemployment of university students. So we have all of those challenges. But the positive thing is that there is a vision and a national policy and strategy to tackle those issues, to improve not only the quality, but more importantly, to make sure that education is relevant to the needs of the countries. Because so often we have people trained, but who are useless for the country. So first we know what are our priorities, and from that then we adjust our education strategies. So this is what the situation is right now.
Mm-hmm. And when you see all these great conversations happening here, are you going back with something you learned that needs to be changed when you go back? As in terms of when you focus on DRC Congo, is there things that need to be done differently?
Yes, but I also hope that those with whom we are exchanging here also learned something about the situation in DRC and about what can be done. We are quite clear on what needs to be done. And we think that there cannot be a true path to development in DRC without education. Not only primary, but also secondary and university. So what my main focus right now is really the relevance of the education. Are we educating people to be relevant for the country? I think this is one of the key challenges.
If I read between the lines, I'm thinking,
yes,
you're saying that we need to, as Africans, we need to also find out what is it that is important to be incorporated into education.
Yes.
Because education is just not what the Western world tells us.
No. Absolutely. You know, Myself, I got educated in Congo. Then I went to the U.S. to do my doctorate and my graduate studies. So there are many Africans today who are proud of having been educated in Oxford, Cambridge, or whatever. But when will we have Europeans and Americans proud of being educated in Africa? This is very important. It shows that there is an asymmetrical balance of power even in education. So this is another challenge we need to tackle.
I quite agree with you, because when I listen to some of the conversation, they're like some African universities wishing for a certificate from London. It got me thinking, where's your pride?
Good question.
Where's your pride?
Yes.
It's a university, not a college.
No. You see? No, this is... you see, this is why I said that there needs to be a paradigmatic change. We really need to look at these things very differently. This is why I welcome opportunity like this one, to be able to exchange with different people, having different experience and expertise, and knowing different realities, so that we can move forward.
It is true. And when you talk about also, we came across a lot of factors that affect education. We know DRC, Congo, has been going through all these moments of conflict, whether it's M23, whether it's these other militia groups, all this happening. Is the government doing something to maybe end all these fighting groups? Because it could be one of the areas that education, access to education, is really happening on that realm of things.
Yes, you are absolutely right. What the government is doing now is, first of all, to use only diplomatic means to end that crisis. We all know what is behind that crisis. We know that it has to do with minerals. So we are using all diplomatic means for that. At the same time, we are beefing up our security apparatus to be able to protect our people and our services. Because in that region of the east of Congo, because of the war, schools have been destroyed. People are displaced, more than 1 million. And when people are displaced, they don't have access to basic social services like health and education. So this is why we'll continue to use diplomatic means, but also military means, to end this. We want peace. We need peace, and we will have peace.
Your Excellency, when you look at DRC, Congo, the size of Eastern Europe, can be full of minerals, natural resources, wildlife, gorillas, names, all this. When you look at that, and when you think about if there was sustainable peace, and if these vibrant young people got education, of course, informed by what you're saying, would you agree with me? I think the country would be really on fast lane of development by now.
Yes.
But what do you think maybe government can do to achieve that? Because that would be the ideal situation.
What the government is doing is, of course, working on improving the political and economic governance, making all efforts to be at peace with our 9 neighbors. We have 9 neighbors. Once we have peace, once we have economic and political governance, this country will take off. That's for sure. It will take off. But we also know that there are people who would not like to see that. Will prefer to have this chaos and the troubles so that they can plunder our riches and minerals. But we are committed to make a difference. We are a peaceful nation. We want peace, and we'll work for that.
Are we looking for Africa's solution for Africa problems, or are we looking to, all the time we call it, we are looking up to the international community?
No, actually, we have many results. Our first approach, of course, is Africa, because we think that we can find sub-regional solutions and regional solutions. So this is our main first approach. But at the same time, we know that Africa is no longer an island. It doesn't live by itself. There is also the Security Council, so we are also working with that. In fact, today, our president is in Lusaka precisely to discuss regionally on that very issue. Yes, so we are optimistic.
So work is happening.
Yes, work is happening at the African level as well.
Oh, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's good. So, yeah, in terms of education, then, of course, you mentioned you are doing a lot of things to focus away. Maybe a last question is will be like, when you look into that desire that you illustrate here, talking about African-oriented programs, how far has that gone to the institutions themselves?
Yes.
And is there a push from the government?
Yes. You know, there is this Congolese American philosopher, because he has been living in the U.S. for quite long. He's called Mudimbe. And he wrote a couple of books. One of them is called The Invention of Africa. And in that book, he discusses what he calls the colonial library, which is actually the knowledge, all what is written about Africa, mainly by the West. So his idea is that the first thing we need to do is to decolonize that knowledge. And I think this is one area where the government has the possibility to act, to have very good university, and more importantly, to have mechanism of publications. Because if you read many publications today, you don't see many Africans. So this is a true challenge. Yeah, we need to have this African knowledge producing mechanism.
This is Colorful Radio.
And to further this conversation, I'm joined by the governor of Edo State in Nigeria, His Excellency Godwin Obaseki.
Yeah, welcome to Africa in Focus, which is my show. And say hello to our listeners.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's nice to be in the UK. I want to congratulate those organizers of the African Summit for their 10th edition of the summit. 10 years is a decade.
Yes.
It shows how much work has been done, and with the quality of the summit, the quality of the participation, I'm quite happy that I've been invited.
That's great. So therefore, we come to you, and of course, brilliant presentation you gave in the morning, so it was very informative. I'm quickly going to make an observation, like focus a bit more on Nigeria, and especially the state that you represent. What is the state of education there in terms of accessibility?
I would say in the last 7 years, since we started the reform of our educational system, we've seen a lot more participation. There's a lot more access here. What's this reform? It's about transforming and making public education a lot more accessible and also more qualitative. So we're making sure that the learning outcomes are improved, that children, our pupils and students get benefit of going to school, and they learn and are prepared for life with life skills. What we have seen is that we've seen enrollment go up. because we continue to, part of a reformist campaigning and trying to get parents to bring their children to school so that we can further improve on the out-of-school population. We've also seen many parents move their children from private schools to government schools, to public schools, because, you know, public education is free. But before now, most parents, because the quality wasn't there, most parents would rather, you know, take their children into private schools. We've also, you know, seen a situation where the learning outcomes, we're now beginning to measure learning outcomes, you know. So what do we expect a child at 7 years old to know? How many words per minute is that child expected to read? In terms of numeracy skills, what are we expecting? So we are able to measure learning outcomes. And these kids are doing fantastic. They're just doing very well. And from the last assessment we did, the average Edo child today is reading at about 70% of his peer or her peer in Europe. Same thing with their numeracy skills. So we think we've made significant progress. There's still a lot of work. We because these are just early beginnings, we have to sustain what we're doing. We have to improve on what we're doing and see how we can also, you know, share knowledge and share experience with other countries. I must just say that when we got a delegation, we've got delegations from African countries. The Rwandan government sent people to us when they were challenged also and were doing work in improving, you know, the quality of basic education to come and understand what we've done. Because what's different about our reform, it's like it's large scale, right? Mm-hmm. Where we're using technology to transform the way we teach. So we've trained over 15,000 teachers. And we have almost 400,000 kids in the system. So it's about a whole systems change on a large scale.
Your focus on training trainers is key, isn't it? Because I've seen, for example, in Kenya, they talked about giving children at the year one level laptops, but they didn't actually start with the teachers. So what do you say about training trainers? How important is it, more than implementing a policy? Before the implementation of a particular educational policy, it begins with the teachers. Do you think that's important?
That's the secret behind our transformation. The first thing we did was, you know, run a pilot, and we got the first lot of 2,000 teachers and ran them through the process. And the reception was just phenomenal. They were all very excited. They could see how easy technology has made their work. They can see, you know, unlike in the past, they had to sit down, write their lesson notes, you know, do all the work, all the hard work. Today, all of that is standardized. They've been part of preparing the lesson notes. And the pedagogy has been changed such that the teachers have been trained to make learning fun for these kids, you know, so there's very active participation in the classroom. The emphasis has been to train the teachers on observing these children in class and ensuring that they participate. So, you're right. For us, by just making sure that the emphasis and the focus is on the teachers, then the teachers are taught to use technology appropriately. You've ensured that first the kind of efficiency you want to see is there, kind of data that you need for decision making is there, and you can now also monitor and evaluate what's going on in the classroom and with the pupils. The other thing that we have, I mean, that has done for us is that once you go through that stage of ensuring that the teacher has control of the classroom, the teacher is in charge, then you can now begin to improve the governance structure of the schools. Because somebody has to be in charge, somebody has to be held responsible, somebody has to be held culpable if things are not going well. And now, on the other hand, you also begin to reward and compensate those teachers that are doing well and you know, or have done well.
And then another controversial quick one, also education, because I do think it's important also to bring African elements to the educational curriculum.
Certainly, as we define the curriculum, you know, we bring parties together, you know, make sure that in writing the new curriculum, the whole spectrum of society is reflected in terms of recommending the books they use. Local publishers are brought to the table to be part of developing the texts that are used, and so that it's the children learn within the context of their community and their society. The other thing we've done with this reform is that the communities are involved. So we have what we call school-based management committees, where not just parents, community leaders, religious leaders, are also who are in the community take an interest in what's going on with the schools. And that way, you know, behaviors of the children are mutually monitored and corrected. So you're learning within the context of your society and your community.
Because of time, we are going to end it there. But our listeners,
I'm there. Shorty says she miss me, I'm on my way, yeah. But I can't lay off. Girl, you know the vibe. Girl, we outside, pulling with the bros. End of the night, you know, taking her home. We outside, you already know. She got a man, but she ready to go. That girl is boozy. I'ma turn her into a movie. We outside, I'ma slide, they calling me Tuesday. Nigga, moving walkies, weddies up in jacuzzis. We been running, smoking the like Lucy. Coop is a Bluetooth, she's trying to do me. And y'all be rapping in circles like this a doobie. Everybody win, just take your time. She don't play no game, she play with your mind. Girl, you know the vibe, girl, we outside. Pulling with the bros. End of the night, you know I'm taking her home. We outside, you already know. She got a man, but she ready to go. She lying to her bestie. Just try to get next to me. Your man on your body. You tell him you ain't puffin' nobody. The kitty got mileage. Why you lying and tellin' him I'm your stylist? This nigga tweaking, he about to do some wild like wild shit. Ooh, say what, say what, say what. And you know you invited, baby. Ooh, girl, you know what's up. And you know how to pop it, baby. Ooh, say what, say what, say what. You know that I got it, baby. Ooh, girl, you know what's up. Say what? Hustling all day. Shorty says she miss me, I'm on my way, yeah. But I can't lay off. Girl, you know the vibe. Girl, we outside, pulling with the bros. End of the night, you know I'm taking her home. We outside, you already know. She got a man, but she ready to go.
It's the feature presentation.
Say I blindly be lie lie. I call you to say something and the lie lie. I call you to say something and the lie lie. You are my sunshine.